Well, welcome to PCMC. I'm Mike Buongiorno. I'm joined today by Martha Diaz. Hello.
Hello.
How are you today?
I'm not bad.
Not bad. Good.
Given 2021.
Yeah. Martha, you're the furthest a guest has ever. Well, we're doing it through Zoom, so you haven't gone anywhere. But you are this is the greatest distance in which we've recorded. I record in New York, and where are you?
I'm in Vienna, Austria.
How are things there?
Things are fine, I guess. I mean, we were off to a really good start at the beginning of the pandemic. And now we are at lockdown. Well, getting out of lockdown number, I think, 3 or 4 it was, trying to pretend that everything is getting better. But we're pretty slow on vaccinations here, so.
Okay. Here in New York, things are really kind of, I'd say in the last month, beginning to feel kind of like normal. We've had people not wearing masks the whole time for whatever political reason that they think that political statement they think they're making. But I've decided, and I've told everyone, that I will wear a mask forever. I did not catch a cold this year for the first year in my existence. And I thought, well, that's wonderful. I enjoyed that. And, I have OCD, and I think the pandemic has made me think differently about, it's given me new fears. The idea of being in a crowded place without a mask now truly terrifies me.
I am completely on the same boat. I cannot imagine. I'm not taking the mask off. I haven't been vaccinated yet, and I can't wait until it finally happens, but even once I do have a vaccination, there's no way. I don't want your cold. Like, I don't care if it's not COVID. I still don't want your germs, whatever it is. Why should I want to have them? I don't understand.
Here in America, people used to make jokes and snicker at Chinese people visiting wearing masks and going, isn't it so weird that the Chinese do this? And now, how things have changed. They had the right idea.
Yeah, I mean, it's the same thing here in Europe. I'm currently enrolled in this French class that's way above my French level. But anyway, here at the University of Vienna. And we had this conversation early on in the semester about the pandemic and about wearing masks, not wearing masks, the regulations, what they thought about it. And most of the students in this class are kids. They're in their early 20s or late teens or whatever. And they're all like, oh, you know, the mask thing is ridiculous. You don't get rid of that. You don't get that sick from it, blah, blah, blah. So the teacher said, well, is there anything that you would want to continue doing even after the pandemic? And I said, well, I think it would be great if at least on public transportation, everyone would wear a mask. Because, right. I mean, you already know that you're breathing everyone's germs in now, right? We've all seen the graphics explaining the way that COVID spreads and the aerosols and all this. And everyone just looked at me like I had lost my mind. They were like, absolutely not. That's something that Asians do here in Europe. We are different and we believe in liberty. And so absolutely not. And I thought, well, it just makes sense to me. I don't understand.
Well, it's good to know that it's not just Americans who are ignorant, that we don't have a premium on being completely selfish and ignorant.
You don't. But I mean, Europe is your grandfather, I guess. I mean,
Right. We're still talking about white privilege and ignorance.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, so you and me went to grad school together. Well, you're in grad school now, right? Are you someone who never stops going to school?
I guess I'm hooked on getting some sort of approval from some sort of professor to feel good about myself. I don't know.
Well, that's the cult. we met because we were going together through a film program. And your sort of focus of study was David Lynch and the films of David Lynch, whereas mine was David Cronenberg. Let me ask you, after graduate school ended and I wrote my thesis, I really like turned away from David Cronenberg. Like, it's not like I don't like him or appreciate him, but I don't go out of my way to watch his films. I don't really think or talk about him anymore. Do you have a similar experience with David Lynch?
Yes, it's part of the reason why I chose to do Wild at Heart and not Fire Walk With Me, because Fire Walk With Me is so long. And I honestly, I don't think I could sit through it, especially because I spent so much time watching that one. But Yeah, he's lost a certain amount of appeal, and I don't know if it's because I spent so much time watching his stuff over and over again while I was writing this thesis, or because I've just changed as a viewer and I want something different from what I'm watching. I don't know what it is, but yeah, I did have that experience.
Yeah, yeah. You know, something, academia works very, very slowly. So something about this, that hyper focus, you know, like with this podcast, every week I'm thinking and talking about something different. And the speed in which I go through topics feels so much more germane to my nature than when I spent, you know, 3 years thinking about, you know, a handful of films and watching them a million times.
Yeah, I don't know what it is. I think it's just that maybe it also brings a certain amount of stress when I'm watching Lynch. If I watch Lynch, I can't just watch it. Sometimes it feels like I'm still working on this assignment in my head. Wow. So I was a little bit traumatized by that.
I think that's true for me as well. Like a couple years ago, Cronenberg wrote his first novel, and I read it. And I couldn't help but go back into that little tool bag that I had created for myself. And yeah. Well, you said it already. What we're going to talk about today is Wild at Heart from 1990. This is actually a David Lynch film I haven't seen until in preparation for this, I watched it a few times. I guess you kind of answered it, but what about this film? Why did you choose this film, or what is too interesting about this film?
Well, since 2016 and the whole election, so that was when The Return came out, right? It was around that same time period.
Yeah, Twin Peaks, The Return.
And I just had this, again, every time I watch Lynch, I feel like I'm in thesis writing mode. I was watching the show and I couldn't just sit back and relax and watch it. I was watching it and taking notes and thinking, wow, this is really, really political for Lynch. Mm-hmm. It's how I was reading it at the moment, I think. And I think it was just because of all the Trump nonsense going on. And then back in, I think it was October of last year, I decided, you know what, let me just have a look at Wild at Heart, just because I felt like watching a Lynch film. And I thought, it's a decent length. It's not something that I'm going to, you know, spend 3 hours on. It's not Inland Empire, for example. And so I watched it and I thought, so this was obviously after 2020 and a year that was, again, pretty heavy on the politics for me in terms of watching the news and everything going on in the US. And I watched it just earlier today in preparation for this so I could have everything in my mind. And I just saw a completely different movie.
Really?
Not that I could completely ignore what I had seen politically before, but it just felt a lot more emotional and a lot more of what certain Lynch scholars and Lynch himself says the film is about. More of this emotional lovey-dovey thing between the main characters.
Yeah, I'm not nearly as well-versed as you in Lynch. I mean, I'm a big fan of Twin Peaks and all, you know, Twin Peaks, the original series, the revival, the Fire Walk With Me movie. I've seen Eraserhead probably the most because I used to show that in a class that I taught. But I haven't seen Straight Story. I haven't seen Inland Empire. I haven't seen Mulholland Drive. So there's plenty I haven't seen. But just what I know of Lynch from what I have seen and read, I was kind of surprised at this film because it is, I would read it as more hopeful. It ends in a hopeful way. It's got a happy ending, which completely thwarted me because, and I've said this before on the podcast, I think the ending of Twin Peaks The Return is one of the saddest endings of anything ever. I can't think of, it's like Don Quixote. It's like, I can't think of a protagonist failing so spectacularly and it being so tragic as the end of Twin Peaks The Return. So I guess I had in my head that everything Lynch is not just dark and violent and surreal, but also like sad. And it's not. At least that's how I read the film. It's not. It's pretty like a love story.
Yeah, that's how I saw it earlier today. It's just, you know, Sailor and Lula and then all of these Wizard of Oz references and this whole idea about, you know, goodness and at the end, you know, running back to her and saying, "Love me tender." Yeah. It's really sappy. And apparently, and I haven't read the book, I tried to read the novel by Barry Gifford, which is what it's based on, yeah. But I really couldn't get past like the first couple of chapters. I didn't think it was that interesting.
Right. I imagine that Lynch was not very faithful.
Well, according to some stuff that I read, again, this was last year, I think that it was close to it because he worked with Barry Gifford on some things.
Yeah.
But he changed the ending and he purposely made the ending happier. So it's interesting that you actually pointed that out because that was a choice that Lynch made. Apparently the book ends on a bleak note. I can't remember what it was, but Lynch wanted to have this happy ending. I think it's because he was feeling it or something.
Wow. Probably some version of them not being together. And
yeah,
Lynch probably put them together. And he sings Love Me Tender.
Yeah.
And it's nice.
It's very touching. However, at the same time, there are some, you know, really fucked up things.
Oh, sure.
Film. Like, so, I mean, as usual.
Don't bring your kids to this. This is still a David Lynch film.
Of course. Honestly, I like this idea that we are all a bit like Lula when she's in the room with Bobby Peru. Ooh. In that really tense rape scene.
Yeah.
And that's what we are as the audience when we're watching a Lynch film and he wants us to, you know, say the thing or, well, watch his film. Wow. And then he just walks away and he walks away as if it's a joke, right? He like turns around and instead of doing something horrible to her, he just makes that rape joke about, oh, you know, I would fuck you, but I've got other things to do and I'll see you later.
Wow. That's a really interesting thing. Hey, you know, right up here at the top, let's say trigger warning. For listeners, because this film involves rape and assault and violence, and I should also say spoiler warning. In fact, I want to really talk about this film, so I think if you haven't seen Wild at Heart, go and see it and then come back and listen to this, because we're really going to talk about it. Let me lay down a little bit of groundwork. The film stars Laura Dern and Nicolas Cage as Sailor and Lula. They are young lovers. He is doing an Elvis impression. And he kind of has an Elvis vibe to him. She is, I don't know how to describe her. She's constantly chewing gum. Laura Dern even said that was the key for her to find the character to constantly be chewing gum. And they go on an odyssey. Lula's mother, played by Diane Ladd, who's actually Laura Dern's actual mother, she wants to keep them apart and she wants to actually have Sailor killed, because we find out that Sailor was a witness to, or she thinks he was witness to, Lula's father being killed, because the mother had the father killed. It's actually, for a David Lynch film, a pretty clear plot that works out. It's a very film in a sense. And well, to go back to what you were just saying, there is a very uncomfortable assault scene where Bobby Peru, played by Willem Dafoe, he's this creepy guy that they've just met. They're on an odyssey. They're kind of on the road and they stop at, is it called Big Tuna?
Yeah, Big Tuna, Texas.
Big Tuna, Texas, in this little, I guess it's like a motel kind of trailer park. I'm not exactly sure. And Bobby Peru lives there or is staying there. And he first comes in and a Sailor is off doing something. And Lula is in the room alone. She's wearing, she's always wearing these wild outfits. And she's got on red heels, like Dorothy. Bobby comes in and he menaces her and he grabs her crotch and he says, I'll leave if you say fuck me. And she eventually does say it. And then he leaves. He goes, oh, sorry. Like you said, I can't do it now. I'll see you later. So he assaults her and she submits to him. And then he leaves her. Like, all he wanted was the power of that. Oh, and she is so disturbed by that, she clicks her heels like Dorothy, trying to undo it. So I think it's really funny that you said that's almost like a metaphor for us
watching this Lynch film. Yes, we are surrendering to all of these horrific things that he's putting us through, and then at the end it's just a joke. I mean, we have that, he makes fun of the whole thing, the dog walking away with the hand.
Yeah.
See, that was absolutely hilarious. He turned something that could be quite tragic and made it completely ridiculous.
Yeah, I think Lynch is in general funnier than people give him credit for. I think there are in his films genuine jokes. I still think one of the funniest things ever is in Twin Peaks The Return. There's a scene where somebody's head is exploded and they're in the back of a car and they've got no head and there's just blood and guts everywhere. And Lynch himself playing Gordon Cole, the FBI agent, like just leans in and looks at the headless body and goes, yep, he's dead. And just the timing of this most ridiculously obvious statement, I just laugh out loud. But that being said, I think this movie is funnier than his typical movies. This might almost be, in his mind, a comedy.
Probably. Yeah, I think he might agree with that. And that might be the part of the reason why he wanted to make it a happy ending, because that would make sense.
Yeah. How do you think this movie fits into the rest of the David Lynch canon? Or doesn't fit?
Well, it still has these ideas of some sort of evil, that this underlying evil that's there.
Yeah.
That the characters have to kind of live with or, you know, try to survive, get away from, which is what they're trying to do in this film when they hit the road or trying to get away from the source of evil. There's, you know, all of these scenes with the crystal ball. There's, you know, there's this kind of hard determinism sometimes in his films, I think, that his characters can't really escape.
Yeah.
Their kind of lot in life and all this evil that they have to deal with. The extreme violence, of course, but this one in particular, I found it to be a pretty racialized violence. I mean, that opening scene after, you know, everything has been going on lately, watching it again. I mean, it's just so, it's one of the more gruesome Lynch violent scenes. I mean, that this man's head is just completely bashed on this floor till his brains are, you know,
it's an aggressive, wild opening for the film, especially a film that, as we said, turns out to not be that violent. It's just this explosively violent opening that's just shocking.
And then it's just kind of glossed over as it's like, oh, you know, when they're talking about what his charge was, because he ends up going to prison for killing this man, and he says, oh, you know, you're with a murderer. She was like, no, a manslaughterer. As you know, it really wasn't that bad that you killed this guy.
Yeah.
Well, when we think of like the level of danger that he could have possibly been in to justify this killing, it was pretty low level. And then when we look at all the characters, we have Bobby Peru, who's racial identity is pretty iffy. We don't know what that is, but you know, Peru's in there. We have
he seems to
Juana.
Bobby Peru seems to be in some kind of blackface. There's a darkening to his
Willem
Dafoe's face for sure. That's happening
for sure. Yeah, and then when they ask him, "Are you from Texas?" he says, "Oh, I'm from all over."
Right.
So this we don't know what his origin is. Then there's the scene where we first meet Mr. Reindeer, and then there's just, you know, there's just this brown girl dancing topless while he sits on the toilet and answers the phone.
Yeah.
Like, she's just, and this is actually Lynch's most diverse movie, but all of the non-white characters are just horrible people for the most part, right, unless they're performers in New Orleans. They're black performers, and then, you know, they're just in the background, but otherwise they're, you know, terrible people.
Yeah. Race is something that Lynch has always not been good with. Yeah, he's always even in, like, I'm thinking about, like, in Twin Peaks The Return, there's like the only African-American people I believe you see are like gang members.
I honestly, it's been too long since I've watched it, so I can't remember,
but yeah, it's a problem for sure.
I just honestly, it's something that I hadn't given a lot of thought of in his other films, because
there just aren't any people.
There aren't any. They're just such minor, or obviously, you know, Twin Peaks with the chief, it's just a completely different thing entirely that he's doing there. He's romanticizing it there a bit more than anything else. But in Wild at Heart, it's just so in your face. It's like, yes, you murder this black man, but you're still the hero of the story, and we're kind of just supposed to be like, oh yeah, whatever, it's just something that you do when you want to protect your girl.
Right.
And then just all these other really horrible characters who are, I think, associated with this underlying strain of evil throughout the film that Sailor and Luna can't seem to get away from.
Right.
They all just happen to be, you know, the non-white characters.
Yeah. Well, I think let's talk about that a little bit, because I think there is in all of Lynch a feeling of there is evil in the world, and that evil is in some way tied into modernity. In Twin Peaks The Return, part 8 or episode 8 is this black and white episode that's kind of a prequel. It's almost a prequel to all of Lynch's work. Mm-hmm. And I believe it's supposed to be happening at the same time that the first nuclear weapons are being tested. And it's this idea, and then there's images of gas stations. I feel like there's this idea of the modern is bad. The modern is inherently and fundamentally evil and to be distrusted.
Yes. I think it's evil because it somehow has moved us away from certain ideas of spirituality, not necessarily religion.
Right.
But some sort of spiritual connection to the world, which would kind of fit in with his whole transcendental meditation thing and his kind of own personal philosophy. So I could definitely see that. And yeah, that the episode 8 of The Return, which was really just like a standalone origin story for all of Lynch's work, like you said, starts with this nuclear bomb and this particular moment, and that's where it's all born of. Yeah,
right. That's where if you're to track a narrative onto Twin Peaks, that bomb is where Judy, the mother of all evil, is released, and then at some point she gives birth to Bob, and Bob is, you know, the whatever, the spirit, demon, whatever, that possessed Leland Palmer, and he killed his daughter Laura Palmer. Yes. After assaulting her a lot, which is what I think people really didn't like about Fire Walk With Me. I love Fire Walk With Me, but I think, you know, putting myself in the place of the audience, like, you've had 2 seasons of Twin Peaks. It's kind of a goofy, weird, surreal, like, parody of a soap opera. And now you're seeing basically a horror movie that has a lot of incest and rape in it. And it's not at all like the TV show you thought it was related to.
Well, what I find really interesting is that because he shows this kind of, I don't know, this return to the concept of evil in this particular way, like this iteration of it through supernatural evil, there is no accountability for the characters. Like, these people just get away with it because it's just like, oh, it's not really Leland who raped his daughter. It's not his fault that he was possessed by Bob and Bob is evil. Like, it's completely out of his hands. Again, it's this hard determinism that he didn't really have a choice. So, and it's in all of his films, his characters get to do pretty gruesome things and get away with it because it's not their fault. There's evil in the world. And if we look at law enforcement, I was thinking about this going back to Wild at Heart. They're pretty much just a joke to Lynch because he doesn't like authority figures anyway.
Sure.
And I thought it was really hilarious that he named the jail that Sailor goes to the PD institution. Just PD, like P-E-E-D-E-E.
Yeah.
PD. Police, they're just a joke to him, really. He's pretty libertarian when it comes to stuff like that. This whole idea that people can get away with things because it's not really their fault. I mean, how can we really blame Leland when we find out that it's Bob?
Right. But let me ask,
there's no justice.
What do you think about then Agent Cooper from Twin Peaks? Because I feel like he at least makes the FBI seem like a force for good.
Ah, yes, but only when he uses kind of supernatural means of trying to find the answers. There's no actual detective work in terms of like rational, logical, kind of, you know, modern thinking that gets him ahead in the game. It's really going back to something more spiritual and listening to the log lady and the advice that the chief gives him that leads him on this spiritual journey to find the real answers. But law enforcement using modern technology or modern methods to find the answers, they always fail in all of his films.
So do you think that there's something simple about his worldview?
Yeah, I think so. Everyone likes to read his films in their particular way, as is their prerogative, but sometimes they make it seem like he's a little bit more complex than it actually is. I think when he says that's what he's showing you, I'd say, yeah, it is. I mean, light and dark, good and evil,
yeah.
People caught up in it, not really their fault.
Yeah.
But if you do some transcendental meditation, you might be able to get out of it.
Yeah, we should say, if you don't know, the director David Lynch is to transcendental meditation as Tom Cruise is to Scientology. Although I wouldn't claim that transcendental meditation has committed the crimes and the coercion and all of the bad stuff that Scientology is accused of. But I mean it in the sense that he is the celebrity advocate for it. The David Lynch Foundation gives free TM lessons to victims of abuse, and it's really what he thinks.
Veterans for PTSD, things like that. Yeah. Inner city school children.
Yeah. And if you don't know what TM is, transcendental meditation, it is the form of meditation where the person meditating has a mantra, which is like a secret thing. You're not supposed to share your mantra. And you repeat it over and over and over again. And some, including Lynch, believe that there's something spiritual to it. My understanding would be that by automatically repeating the same thing over and over again, you're just kind of hacking your brain, which gives you space to sort of feel whatever. But the reason I think it's important is because it is closely related to his art. He's been doing it for like over 20 years. People who do TM do it twice a day. And like many great directors, when asked what things are about or what they may symbolize, he always says, "I don't know." And he'll say, "It just came to me. It just came to me in a meditation, or it just came to me in a dream. And I don't know what it's about." Do you think that's genuine?
His whole thing is Catching the Big Fish, which he wrote a book called Catching the Big Fish about his method for coming up with his stories and how he never really knows what a movie is going to be about. He kind of just goes with the flow.
Yeah.
He'll get an idea, then he'll just go with it. I don't know. Will we ever really know the truth about that?
What do you think? I mean, is he being disingenuous? Is there more thought behind some of the things he's saying, or is he just, or is it really just
I think he really is just like that, and he really does just go with the flow. But I think that he's afforded that because he got to the stage where he got the auteur stamp, and then he can just do whatever he wants, right? Once you get that label, which he already had by the time that he made Wild at Heart.
Yes.
And Fire Walk With Me, right? Blue Velvet, having done The Elephant Man, that all really helped him out. Right. And it's something that he worked on. So once he was labeled auteur, now everything that he made was a David Lynch film, and he could just do that. He was still going to get funding mostly from European producers, most half the time, and he was going to be able to do whatever he wanted. So I think it was Inland Empire, which is, you know, famously he started doing without a full script and kind of just like went with it. Would come up to the actors and be like, "Okay, this is what you're going to do next," that kind of thing. So I believe it, but it is only made possible by his status as auteur and having done The Elephant Man.
You know, it's so interesting. As you describe that, someone who works in an extremely similar fashion is Michael Bay. Michael Bay, I've heard that actors will be on the call list and they'll go and do nothing all day. And they'll just say, "He might use you today, so stick around." Basically, if you're in a Michael Bay movie, the script doesn't matter. You are just like, you know, a color in his palette. And he'll bring you in and be like, "Do this, try that." And it's so funny because you probably can't imagine directors more disparate than Michael Bay and David Lynch. Yeah. They're kind of doing the exact same thing. And they're both kind of generals. I know Michael Bay is very scary to be around, and he will yell and he will, you know, if you have the wrong plant, he'll yell at you to get the right plant. And Lynch is the same way. I mean, you could easily find online footage of Lynch freaking out on people on set because they've gotten in the way of some idea or something he's trying.
And it's probably been, you know, 5 minutes since his last cigarette and coffee. So yes, he's probably on edge.
I'm drinking coffee now, and I have not smoked a cigarette in about 4 years. But once a smoker, always a smoker. And, you know, we're all one bad day away from being a smoker again. I'm one bad day away from picking up a cigarette again. And so I almost want to smoke a cigarette because I feel like there's something key to Lynch in the idea of, like, the thing that we're all told to see. This is what's so ironic, because modernity is bad, right? Yet He thinks sugar is good. He thinks fat is good. He thinks caffeine is good. He thinks tobacco is good. When asked about his smoking habits, he says, I deeply love tobacco. And he has no concern about whether it's good for him or bad for him. I mean, he loves milkshakes. He loves fast food.
Yeah, he loves it. He's a hedonist. He's so, again, but this is the stuff that was so quintessentially 1950s America, right?
Yeah.
Hamburgers and Coca-Cola and cigarettes, because they were healthy for you back then, right?
Right.
And he loves it. He absolutely loves it. He loves America. He's really so quintessentially American, and that's part of what makes him so interesting sometimes. Have you heard him on the Rush Limbaugh show? He went on Rush Limbaugh.
No.
Listen to that. He was on it, and he was really, oh God, it was awful. Wow. It really just gave me the creeps to know that Rush Limbaugh was like, oh yeah, Lost Highway, brilliant film. I love that movie. It was like, oh, why? Yes. And then they had a lovely conversation about 9/11 and how about Lynch was just like, yeah, we'll never really know what happened. I mean, feeding into these conspiracy theorists. And I just thought, oh, but then it makes perfect sense because he's very libertarian. You know, part of the reason why he doesn't like Democrats is because they keep telling him not to smoke and that he can't smoke in a restaurant and wherever he wants.
Right.
So, yeah, he loves the idea of freedom. I mean, I don't know what his mask policy was, but I'm pretty sure he was probably annoyed that he can just go out and smoke in people's faces.
Wow.
I did not know that he was on Rush Limbaugh either until I think it was maybe 2 or 3 years ago that I found out.
I mean, these are search terms I would never put together. Rush Limbaugh and David Lynch. I would never imagine.
I didn't.
Such a thing.
Yeah. I can't remember how it is that I found it, but I did. And I was surprised. But apparently Rush Limbaugh was huge, huge Lynch fan. Loved him.
Okay.
Probably for all like the wrong reasons. Like, oh, I love the misogyny. You know, if you you know. Whatever you want with your women, I don't know.
Right. Wow. Well, David Lynch, he really believes in the auteur theory, which if you've listened to this podcast, you know that I'm not a proponent of the auteur theory. Cinema is a collaborative art form. The auteur theory, it can be useful in terms of a critical mode, but in terms of film production, what it ends up often being is an excuse for men to be mean to people.
Yeah. And that's what I mean. That's why he's been able to get away with making whatever he wants and doing these weird things on film that no, I mean, if you pitched that at any of these film ideas as not David Lynch, would you get funding for it?
No.
Exactly. No. So it's really all predicated on him having the status, which is, you know, a little frustrating, but that's his privilege. That's his privilege.
But you know, why do you think he has this?
It was carefully curated at the time. I mean, this is something that he worked towards.
I don't know. I mean, think about if we can call him a surrealist, which in some ways he isn't because he is so spiritual and surrealist of the, you know, typical.
Yeah, everyone
surrealism.
Who says like, oh, you know, Dalí and Lynch. I was like, not really, though.
Dalí was very political. He was very
exactly and very overtly political. Whereas I think that Lynch will put a lot of stuff out there, but without comment. Like, for example, if you look at all of this, you know, violence and these racial things that we talked about, Wild at Heart, he puts it all on screen, but there's no commentary there. He doesn't actually comment on it, whether good or bad.
Right.
He doesn't really put that any sort of point of view there of his point of view or even character point of view. He just presents it without comment.
Right. But Dalí would be probably, other than Lynch, the most famous surrealist or the surrealist who breached into the mainstream population, like appeared on talk shows and stuff. And it just, I still wonder, like, how did Lynch do it? Like, why is David Lynch not just some professor somewhere who like makes little short films that no one cares about? Like, how did I don't know, like Blue Velvet's big and good and like you said, Elephant Man, but his career baffles me in a sense, because it's like, why?
Yeah.
How did you get to be famous?
Yeah, agreed. Someone did an entire doctoral thesis on it, which is a book now, and he traced this birth of Lynch as an auteur, and it was really all about marketing and knowing the auteur system and exactly what you have to put out there to get that status. I think I read a while back the little booklet that they give you. Why am I forgetting what things were called, for the promo for Blue Velvet.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really, you could see how carefully thought out and curated his little biography was.
Huh.
They thought very carefully about how they were going to describe Lynch and his background. So it was really all very, very carefully curated and thought out. It's something that you know that he purposely wanted to get to.
Yeah.
In order to achieve auteur status.
Interesting.
It wasn't that he just directed these films and then the world saw them and then gave him this. No, he directed the films, talked about himself in a particular way, put on a show in a particular way, did interviews to feed this idea of the auteur. And that's how he got to that point. Mm. Because really, his films aren't really box office successes.
No.
They aren't critically acclaimed when they come out. It's just later on a bunch of academics write about them and they're like, oh yes, you know, let's add this to our syllabus because it seems important. But
right.
He knew that he needed to get to this point of having this auteur clout in order to get the funding to do projects later on.
Right. All right, let's get closer back to the text. There is a motif throughout this film of references to the Wizard of Oz. The Diane Ladd, the mother character, the evil mother, she is, you know, in some ways the Wicked Witch of the West. We see at one point Lula is looking outside of they have a convertible, so she's looking out at the desert as they're driving by, and she sees her mother on the broomstick, like from Wizard of Oz. There's Wizard of Oz references in the dialogue throughout. There's the slippers, there's the Odyssey idea, and then in the very end, they are going to split up, and Sailor is attacked by, again, a gang of people of color.
Yeah.
He calls the F word to antagonize them.
Yes.
And, but while he's sort of dazed and passed out on the floor after being punched in the face, he sees Glinda the Good Witch, played by Cheryl Lee, who played Laura Palmer from Twin Peaks. And she's Glinda, and she says, "Don't run away from love. Lula loves you. Go get her." And then he runs back to her. And I believe none of that is in the book.
Probably not.
No. So how do you read this? Because I can't imagine David Lynch sitting down and watching The Wizard of Oz. Knowing what I know about him.
Really? I think he absolutely would. Because it's such a classic American text and he loves America. I can absolutely see him loving The Wizard of Oz and him seeing himself as The Wizard of Oz.
Okay.
I cannot talk at length about The Wizard of Oz because honestly, I'm not a fan. I don't know what it is. You know what? It just depresses me. It's one of these films that the music depresses me. I just can't get through it without just feeling incredibly sad the whole time. The Wizard of Oz. It just does that to me. Yeah.
Interesting.
So I always avoid watching it. I can't remember the last time I watched it. But I don't, I honestly, yeah. It's not, there's this, and it's the, is it a sparrow? What's the bird that comes back in Blue Velvet?
Oh, I don't remember.
It's the same thing with the stupid bird. It's that cheesy scene at the end with like, oh, you know, the bird is about everything. That is so Lynchian. So why wouldn't he do it for this? I mean, honestly, it makes sense for Lynch when you try not to think of anything that he does as ironic, but just very face value. I think that he really just did believe in these two characters being in love and it working out.
Mm-hmm. It's just interesting because I can't think of any other sort of overt intertextual referencing like that. I mean, it's not subtle.
No.
I mean,
but he loves it. Him, like the whole Nick Cage is Elvis, but he kind of sounds like Johnny Bravo too.
Sure.
And just Elvis in general. Again, it's this callback to his idea of America, and it's the same thing with The Wizard of Oz. There's a certain amount of patriotism in a Lynch film.
What do you think his idea of America is?
I guess it can only be his personal experience. He, in this little text that went with the promo for Blue Velvet, I remember there being a little excerpt where he said, so it talks about his bio and how about he grew up in, you know, the suburbs in this perfect idyllic American, the whole spiel that you get when you when you read about Lynch, that he had this like perfect childhood a la opening scene of Blue Velvet.
Yeah.
But then he lived in Philadelphia and it was dark times. And, you know, that's uh-huh. that's when and like and the violence and the things that he experienced in Philadelphia were truly terrible. But then he was able to escape that and go to sunny California. And it's very interesting because obviously the time that he talks about living in Philadelphia, there were a lot of race riots, as they call them, going on. And he lived in a pretty diverse neighborhood. And so this is the kind of darkness that he describes in his own biography, mm-hmm. contrasted with the lightness of his, you know, nice suburban upbringing and then sunny California, because he went from, you know, shitty neighborhood in Philadelphia to AFI, which right. is really nice up in the hills. So
right.
That was it. That was his experience. These are the images that he has of America in his head, I think.
Yeah.
And in Wild at Heart, obviously, the bad is usually the other people.
And they get caught in Texas, but they are heading towards California. That's where they're going, which is itself
a destination.
Right.
Yeah.
Which has deep roots in Westerns and, you know, the idea of, you know, manifest destiny and just, you know, we are, you know. Well, that brings us to another theme. I kind of want to just bring up some themes and motifs and just kind of talk about them with you. I don't think it's fruitful to try to investigate what we think they mean, but I just want to talk about them. So one that appears in this film a lot and in a lot of his other films is highways and the image of like the yellow line in the middle of the highway. I guess one way to think about it in this film is the yellow brick road. Mm-hmm. But then you've also got Lost Highway. And then again, highways are like a symbol of modernity. It was a way of flattening the earth with the highway system. You get suburbs and you get a whole different configuration of how we think of labor and leisure. So what do you think he's thinking about, or you don't have to answer it that way, actually. What do you think about when you see these highways?
I think that highways are not necessarily a bad thing in Lynch films, but maybe you brought up Lost Highway and reminded me of that scene where, again, he's super libertarian, but he's a stickler for driving rules. So he has that scene where
Robert Loggia.
Yeah, gets really pissed off about the guy who cuts him off on the highway and, you know, yeah. chases him down and tells him that he's, you know, a dangerous driver and he's putting people's lives at risk while he's right. beating the crap out of him.
And he's like, don't you know that 75% of accidents are like it's just like spouting.
Yes, exactly. Getting into a car and just going on the road and driving and the freedom from that, that's also something that's really appealing to him and really American. So I think that's yeah. why it comes up so much. And it's the same thing in The Straight Story. Like the road comes up again and again, and it's kind of a way for people to escape, find some sort of independence.
Yeah, yeah. Huh. I'm trying to think about whether I see it as good or bad. Because he does have that simple, some things are good, some things are bad, or evil and good, or light and dark.
Yeah, I don't think that for him the road itself is bad. It's I guess, what the characters use the road for.
Yeah. What do you think about Sailor's snakeskin jacket, which for him represents... Wait, what does he say?
My individual freedom.
Yes, right. He says it more than once, this...
Yeah, he says it two or three times in the film, yeah.
It represents yeah. a symbol of my individuality and my belief in personal freedom.
Yes. So that is really interesting because I thought, oh, you know, that's Lynch putting his, you know, thing about libertarianism or freedom in there. But really, apparently that was Nick Cage's own personal jacket.
Of course it
was.
That
he kind of just wore and said to Lynch, you know, I think that we could, you know, fit this in with the character. You know, what do you think about it? And Lynch loved the idea and then they decided to go with it. But it goes really... If we're going to read into it, I think it goes really well with the, again, it reminded me of the Gadsden flag. Mm-hmm. And people who like to display the Gadsden flag would probably have that same mentality about it representing their personal freedom, right. individuality.
Right. The don't tread on me.
Yes.
There's also a character in Texas who wears a baseball cap with a Confederate flag on it.
Confederate flag on it, yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. I did not think of the snake that way. Snakes are they're such loaded metaphors too, because it could get religious then too as well, mm-hmm. with serpents and snakes and stuff. in some ways, isn't, I think Nicolas Cage is the perfect actor for Lynch, and I'm surprised that he hasn't worked with him more, because David Lynch, as weird as he may be, is all these broad strokes. Like, there's not real deep characterization. It's all these broad strokes. You know, Kyle MacLachlan has been asked, like, what do you think about, like, when you make these movies? And he's like, I don't know, man. I don't know what's going on. I just do it. And I think that's what is interesting to people about Nicolas Cage, is it's also broad strokes. He's an actor who is not in any way going for realism. It's all about just broad strokes. So it's some ways it's like they're perfect for one another. And let me just say, the two, it's a horny movie, and Laura Dern is absolutely gorgeous in it. And even Nicolas Cage, who I don't necessarily think is a handsome man, he has a sort of sweaty magnetism in this film. Their sex scenes, I think, are enjoyable to watch.
Yeah, they are. And it's, I'm trying to think of other sex scenes in other Lynch films, but they are enjoyable to watch. For the most part, they're usually not.
Right. Like, I remember in Twin Peaks: The Return, there's a sex scene, I think, between Laura Dern and Cooper. It's like in the very last episode, and it's very cold and
Exactly. Erotic. That's a perfect word. It's just, it's cold, and that's what it is in Lost Highway as well. It's cold, or it's a snuff film, or
right.
Anyway, getting off Lost Highway, but back to Wild at Heart. Yeah, and I think it's this love that he himself has for the character of Lula and Sailor. Again, it's his belief in their love that made him shoot the scenes in this very
right. Kind
of loving, passionate way.
And it's the opposite of cold, because it's in fact warm. Like, there's a visual motif is fire and matches being lit. And sometimes over their love scenes, there's just a red kind of scrim over the whole image. So it's all red and yellows and orange and desert and heat. It's very, very warm looking, the film. It's a sort of hot, sweaty film with hot, sweaty people.
Having hot, sweaty sex, yeah.
Having hot, sweaty sex. And some of the lines, I think, are amazing. Nicolas Cage says, "I had a boner with a capital O."
Yes.
She says, "You got me hotter than Georgia asphalt."
Yeah.
Which is fantastic.
What did you think of that scene where she takes over and she starts driving and she's listening to the radio and she pulls over because she can't handle it anymore, and because of all the horrible news that is
right, she keeps hearing about murder and death. And, yeah. Well, I didn't know what to think about it, but given this conversation and what I'm learning about him and Rush Limbaugh, I'm thinking maybe it's a very sort of conservative idea. Like, maybe there isn't much nuance there. Maybe it's just Lynch himself going, well, isn't the world just crazy today? Because that's sort of what happens, right? She's driving and
she keeps hearing
these, you know, these negative. It also reminds me of very much of like lame 1990s commentary. Mm-hmm. Like, this movie's made in 1990, and it feels like the kind of thing like a comedian from the 90s would talk about. Just like, oh, there's crazy stuff on the radio. And she's like, I can't handle this. You got to change the radio. And then he puts on some rock and roll and everything's better. So yeah, maybe it's just a conservative, like, aren't people terrible? Or something like that. I don't know.
Terrible. I'm not going to comment on it. So let's just listen to some music instead.
Right.
And also, there's a lot of that in this. You know, he loves music, and he loves, you know, putting live performances in his films.
Yeah.
That kind of thing. It means a lot to him, and you could really tell in this film, because that's Luna's escape, right? And so instead of being political about it or addressing it, it's like, how about we just turn it off and just listen to some good old metal?
Yeah,
do some headbanging. There's that scene in the club as well, in that metal club, where he starts singing Elvis songs, and then we hear this track of like Beatles fans screaming in the background.
Everyone's swooning. Yeah.
Everyone's swooning. So it's very escapist in that
yeah.
way.
What do you think about Cousin Del?
Yes. Watching it earlier today, I just thought, oh, isn't that just, you know, the average QAnon American now, though? I mean, the conspiracy theories, it just seemed like a very normal person now.
Yeah. Cousin Del, who we only know through the film's interesting because we sort of begin in media res, and then there is a series of flashbacks from almost every character as they, and that sort of brings you up to pace of what is going on. And but then there's this one that's sort of non sequitur where Lula is talking about her cousin Del, who loved Christmas, which again, that's so Lynch. He loved Christmas and the spirit of Christmas, and he felt like aliens were somehow brainwashing us into not believing in Christmas or something like that.
Yeah.
And he put cockroaches in his underwear, which is a pretty funny scene, because then it cuts to like, oh, I should say, Cousin Del's played by Crispin Glover, because of course he is.
Yes, of course.
And we see Crispin Glover like kind of like shifting in his, like shifting as like, obviously he's got cockroaches in his underwear, which is probably like Lynch's idea of like a hilarious joke.
Yeah, definitely.
It's so unnecessary. I mean, it doesn't, compared to the other flashbacks that give us some sort of important narrative information about all these characters and where they come from, it's just sort of there. It's like it's short little film inside this film of Cousin Del.
Yeah, it just seems to be another addition to the look at how fucked up the world is. You know, there's all this stuff going on the radio, and I personally know someone who completely disappeared after being obsessed with a conspiracy about aliens.
Yeah.
It's this whole, you know, the whole world is wild at heart and weird on top.
Yes. Yes.
The other thing that I noticed a lot of is that there's a lot of toilets in this film. I don't know what that was about.
Yeah. Well, we see a close-up of a toilet when Lula's mother is threatening Sailor in a stall in a bathroom.
Yeah.
And she says, you're a piece of shit. You belong in a toilet. And then she says, you're a piece of S-H-I tut. She says S-H-I tut, which... By the way, Diane Ladd was nominated for an Oscar for this performance.
Which, was she? I did not know that. Was she?
Yeah, which blows my mind because she's brilliant in it, but she's doing a Lynch performance. She's just being, it's almost like Laura Palmer's mother, but evil and just wild.
Who's also in the film.
Yes, also a character that's problematic and we could get to. And so, yeah, she didn't win, but she was nominated, which is just insane to me because it's just all these broad strokes. And you get the sense that they're playing along with Lynch, but no one really knows what their character is supposed to be doing. Like, I don't think anyone in these films really feels like they understand their character. I think they just feel
honestly, like, they're probably just having a good time. I mean, what better job could you have as an actor?
You're right.
It's not very demanding emotionally.
Right. And he's never going to tell you, like, go smaller.
No.
He's never going to be like, oh, tone it down for this next take. It's always exactly. Bigger. What do you think of when she paints her whole face with red lipstick?
Oh, yeah. She starts with her...
She starts with her wrist.
Her wrist.
Which I believe that was Diane Ladd's idea. She says that she was trying to simulate suicide in some way because she starts rubbing red lipstick on her wrist. But then the next time we see her, she's got it all over her face. And the music and the cinematography seems to present it as this is a scary thing.
Yeah, I think it's supposed to be scary. It just comes off as a bit ridiculous as usual.
Oscar nominated.
but again, it won the Palme d'Or at Cannes. So.
But that was very controversial.
Yeah, it was.
In its first screening, half of the audience left. And even apparently when it was announced as the winner, there was an equal amount of cheers and boos.
Yep.
Which is not unusual for Cannes because they take film very seriously and they will be known to boo. But it is, we should talk about, the thing that happened was there is a scene where Harry Dean Stanton, who plays the detective, he is abducted and killed by, what's her real name? Grace something.
Zabriskie?
Yes, Grace Zabriskie, who played Laura Palmer's mother in Twin Peaks. And in this, she plays Juana. And she's sort of like getting off in it, and she's saying to her partner, like, fuck me. And apparently in the original cut, like, they murder him, then have sex, I guess, over him. I don't know how, but that's what made people leave the theater. And that most of that cut out. So Lynch was like, we got to cut this down.
Interesting. Now, I don't know if you notice that ring that they show him before they kill him? That's, I'm pretty sure, an Islamic symbol. Like, it's a religious symbol.
Oh.
So I also found that incredibly problematic. Like, what is it about anything that is not just regular white Christian American that makes it evil? I didn't understand. Like, why did he have to use that ring?
Right. And it symbolizes...
It could have been any other prop that he could have just made up, but...
It's supposed to symbolize one of the villains, Santos, who is a mob guy. Because when they show it to Harry Dean Stanton, he says Santos, and he knows what's happened to him, why he's going to be killed. But why there's a connection there, I don't know.
I just thought that was really weird.
It's just, now that I'm thinking about it, mob characters appear a lot in his films as villains, right?
They do. Lost Highway, Blue Velvet, Wild at Heart, Mulholland Drive.
Right. And Twin Peaks The Return, you have...
Yes, Twin Peaks The Return.
What's his name? Jim Belushi as the two mob... Jim Belushi and I forget who else as the two mob guys that run the casino.
The casino, yeah. But also Johnny Farragut as this detective who also ends up being useless. He can't.
Right.
He doesn't really get the job done. And what was it that Lula says about him? He says, oh, my mother said he's such a good detective, he could find an honest man in Washington or something.
Yeah, yeah.
That was a description of him.
Yeah, to which Nicolas Cage says, wow.
Impressive.
Yeah, her name is Juana. So, and she's doing some kind of a problematic accent as well.
Yes, she is. And then when Perdita, when Isabella Rossellini's character is in the car outside of the... What was it that they were robbing?
A bank, but it's like a shitty little bank.
Yeah, it's a shitty little bank. And she answers the officer in Spanish, kind of like pretending that either pretending or that was part of her character.
Right. Yeah.
So yeah, it's quite problematic on those terms.
Yeah. I'm trying to think, all the people of color are played by white people.
Yes.
Are they? Except for the one...
Except for the woman who was dancing in the toilet when Mr. Reindeer's in there and picks up the phone.
Right. And she's basically a prop.
Yes, exactly.
And I guess the one real character would be Juana's like boyfriend / partner. He's an African-American guy.
Yes.
Who I guess is a hitman or whatever.
Yeah, that's it.
Do you think this movie has an influence? And I asked this, I have an ulterior motive for asking this because I have my own thought on this, but I want to ask you first, do you think it has an influence?
As in an influence on American culture?
Yeah.
Or on people in general?
Or on film? Or on even Lynch's work? Because I feel like it's not really talked about a lot. Even conversations about Lynch, I feel like it comes up very seldom.
Yeah, and I think that's the other reason why, aside from not wanting to watch a longer Lynch movie at this moment in time, that was another reason why it's not really talked about much. There's not a lot written about it. It's kind of written off as, oh, it's too pastiche. It's just all about The Wizard of Oz, really. Nothing really interesting to say.
Right.
Kind of glossing over all of this other stuff we brought up.
Right.
So I don't know.
Okay, so my thing that I wanted to bring up was, I feel like Quentin Tarantino has taken a lot from this movie. This is 1990. 3 years later, you have Natural Born Killers and True Romance. And True Romance takes so much from this movie, from its plot to the characters, having the male character be obsessed with Elvis, having all the violence. Even one of the villains in Wild at Heart is named Marcellus Santos. And it makes me think of Marcellus Wallace, the crime boss in Pulp Fiction. And I wonder if, Quentin Tarantino has been accused of pilfering other people's work for years. And I just see so much of his early work here. I feel like he takes a lot from this movie.
It's been a while since I watched any of those. I mean, yeah, I can't remember the last time I watched Natural Born Killers.
And True Romance and Natural Born Killers were two parts of one large script that were sort of split in the middle and then went to two different directors that kind of made two different films. But they were originally the same story. And it's a story of, you know, they're on the run. In Wild at Heart, you have Lula, but in True Romance, you have Alabama. And in many ways, she's similar to the Lula character.
Well, I mean, if there was a Lynch film you were going to pilfer from, it might as well be this one because no one's talking about it. So
who
would know if no one's watching this?
right.
Who would know? No, right. Interesting.
I mean, I kind of have a beef with Tarantino. I don't like him as a person, and I really find his films sophomoric. One time, I was very nasty to a student I had at a film in a film class. I asked a student who their favorite director was, and they said Quentin Tarantino. And I very condescendingly said, "Oh, you'll grow out of it," which they were very insulted by. But I truly meant, because I think Quentin Tarantino is the favorite director of someone who's getting into film for the first time. Somebody who's like a young film fan who loves the flashiness and doesn't realize that all of these tricks and gimmicks have been taken from other people. I mean, I did love him when I was in my early 20s, late teens, and then I, in fact, grew out of it.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned this about Tarantino, because he's someone who I think played the auteur game the same way that Lynch did.
Yes.
I think that they both played the same game, essentially.
And they both made themselves celebrities.
Yeah.
Right? For all David Lynch's supposed integrity, he himself...
He sells coffee.
Right. He's a recognizable celebrity. Yeah. He does TikToks, I think.
Well, yeah, he does those YouTube videos where he, you know, says what the weather is.
Right.
And then there's that, you know, that short film with the monkey that was on Netflix, that Netflix produced, that again, I remember watching it thinking, only because it's David Lynch. Like, he's just riding this auteur wave to all of these, you know, side gigs and projects that he's doing.
Right.
Just because.
That film was like a parody of his own films.
Yes, which he gets to do.
Right, he does get to do.
Because he's David Lynch.
Right. I guess he does. Maybe his stuff doesn't cost a lot, so he doesn't have to make a lot.
Yeah, I guess.
But, you know, even he, in the age that we're in now of superheroes and such, you know, he had to turn to Showtime to do Twin Peaks. I mean, Twin Peaks was always a show, but, you know, like you also had, like, you know, Scorsese producing TV shows. I feel like I don't know where the future is for him as a director. Because I don't know who will give him money. Like, maybe he'll just make Netflix movies.
Maybe, but I don't know, have you seen that documentary, that Lynch documentary, like the last one that was released?
Art Life?
Painting, yes, the Art Life.
Yes.
Maybe he's just happy, like, sitting on whatever money he has, selling coffee on wherever he's selling, whatever platform he's selling it on now, David Lynch brand coffee, and painting all the time.
Yeah.
I don't know. Meanwhile, he's 70-something years old and his child is 4.
I know. And there's all these shots in that documentary of this weird old man smoking cigarettes doing, like, art. And then, like, a little girl next to him. Like, an adorable... Like,
wanting some sort of attention. And he's just like,
no.
I'm painting.
No. Right. You see, looking in her presence.
You want a coffee, kid?
Yeah,
coffee and a cigarette, I don't know what to do for you.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, well, that's an interesting documentary because it's all about his life up until Eraserhead. So it's all about, I'm an artist, you know, like it's almost like I happen to accidentally become a filmmaker, but I'm truly an artist, which is
part of his whole auteur image, you know, this idea that he's like, he's not just a director. No, he was an artist. He's a fine artist, you know, a painter. That's what he really does. He just wants to bring these paintings to life.
Yes. I watched his masterclass.
Oh, you did?
Yeah. During the pandemic, my brother conned me into signing up for masterclass as like something to do during the pandemic. And
I considered it. But I'm about to find out if it was, you know, worth doing or not.
I would say it's fascinating and it's interesting and maybe do like the 1 year trial or whatever. Mm-hmm. Because it is. Some of the stuff on there is wild. First of all, it's all like guest lectures. None of it's really like a class. They try to make it like it's really class. You know, sometimes you can like download like a workbook with it. You know who's actually, this is sort of a side note. Neil Gaiman's is almost like a real class. God love him.
Okay, he really that's good because that's the one I wanted to watch. So
his is actually like a class. There's actual like exercises. But Lynch's is just a wild, long interview. And he talks about what you were talking about before, about you got to catch ideas. And I go fishing for ideas.
Catching the big fish all over again.
Oh. And he's like, One, you got to catch ideas, and then when you have 70 ideas, then you've got a movie. And it's like, who is this advice for? This is advice for nobody. Like, nobody could watch this and, you know, learn.
But this is advice for someone who has made a name for themselves as an auteur and can just, you know, give someone this spiel and they'll be like, yeah, here you go. Here's, yeah, you know, $500,000.
It's fascinating. On the last episode of this podcast, I was talking to my brother about, I watched R.L. Stein's masterclass, and it's just, how do you make Goosebumps books? And it's just so wild. You can't get anything from it, basically. Yeah. But it's masterclass is a very interesting. I would not be surprised if we find out in 10 years that it was some sort of a con, if it was some kind of a money laundering scheme. There's something about it that just, because it sells, it's basically a streaming service, but one that costs a lot of money and sells itself on prestige, but it's just willing itself into existence. There's no prestige there. These are just interviews of celebrities. These are basically podcasts, visual podcasts that you're charging people hundreds of dollars for. It's wild.
But, yeah, you know, with the promise of becoming a master.
Yes, yes. Yeah, and yeah, his masterclass is, it's just him smoking cigarettes and just talking. Yeah, do you have any other thoughts that you wanted to get to?
I thought that it's a shame that, you know, Lynch isn't in any way, shape, or form interested in being political, and he just shows this stuff, because there's so much to unpack in Wild at Heart, I think. I mean, there's, you know, the abortion scene. Like, we rarely get to see that. And I kind of thought, you know, that, you know, it was done pretty well. It wasn't judgmental or anything. It was just like, you know, here's this girl. She went through this horrible trauma. She's been raped, and she had to have an abortion. And obviously this is weighing on her now. And she isn't just saying, oh, I'm just going to abort this kid. But she, you know, she just had this flashback to this terrible experience. And watching it this last time, I almost understood why her mother didn't want her running off with some man, you know, because, you know, her daughter had been raped and she had witnessed this and she was completely enraged. We don't really know. I mean, there's a hint of maybe she was having an affair with Santos. Is that why she had her husband murdered? I don't know.
I think so.
Did she have her husband killed because her husband's business associate raped their daughter and she was infuriated with him? Yeah. I don't know.
Well, maybe she was trying to be a good mother. We also find out that the person who raped her died in a car accident, and we see his car careen off of a cliff, which is very obviously not an accident.
Yeah. So is she being a good mother there, trying to, you know, protect her baby from this rapist? I don't know.
That is a powerful scene. And it comes from a moment where, in the present, Lula tells Sailor that she's pregnant and says that she doesn't want to keep it. And she says, it's nothing about you. I just don't feel like you say, like, you wish he were more political. Like, what do you think his politics are? I mean, I can't believe that they're like Rush Limbaugh level conservative. I don't think I don't see him as a hateful person.
No, I don't think he's hateful. I just think that his politics just come from a place of being very privileged. And it's really just, I think that's why he doesn't really go in depth with them in his films, because to him, it's just like, I just want to be able to smoke wherever I want to smoke. And that's about as deep as he's into.
He only cares about his own life.
Because he's not, what disadvantages has this man had? Zero. So he's not really concerned with that. So in that way, it's very easy for him to adopt like a libertarian approach, because it's like, well, yeah, of course, you know, he lives a life of privilege in his nice, you know, Hollywood Hills house, and he paints and he makes movies once in a while, but he's really unaffected by politics the way that some other members of society are. So
from that abortion scene, what do you think he thinks on that? You think he's pro-life, pro-choice?
I think he's pro-choice. Because I don't think that he judges her harshly.
No, I don't think so either. But he does make it look horrible.
Yeah, but I can't imagine anyone his age making abortion look like not
deal
horrible. Because he wanted these characters' lives to be kind of shitty, and this was part of the motivation for them being on the road and, you know, wanting to be together. I think he wanted to give them that extra trauma. I thought it was interesting just because there's this, it's kind of difficult to differentiate the sounds of pleasure during the sex scenes and the sounds of her having the abortion. They're quite similar moans.
Yeah.
Whether pleasure or pain, they're very, very similar.
Yeah. Well, if you haven't seen Wild at Heart, check it out. Martha Diaz, thank you so much for coming on and talking about this film with me.
Thanks for having me. It was a good time.
Martha, we end every episode by saying go bye-bye. Will you say go bye-bye for us?
Go bye-bye.